The Bob Murphy Show, episode 32.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Welcome everyone to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. I am very happy to have as my guest today, Lou Rockwell. I'm sure most of you know who he is, but in case you don't, he is the founder and current chairman of the Mises Institute, which is in Auburn, Alabama, which is the preeminent place to go and study Austrian economics, particularly in the Rothbardian variety. Let me just take a minute to explain my debt to the Mises Institute. I started going there in the summers when I was a grad student at NYU, and it just changed my life. And for those of you who are into Austrian economics, especially like if you're a fan of Tom Woods, then you're going to love the Mises Institute. And in particular, if you've never been, I strongly encourage you to go to Mises University at least once. There's really nothing else like it. It's a week of just nonstop immersion in really like serious academic study. Like you're really learning economic theory and you'll love it. And it's amazing and it's fun. It's not like, oh, wow, this is really tough and a chore, but, you know, it's important. No, it's they somehow make it fun. I meant to ask Lou in our interview if he had any insight into how is it that Mises University is so much fun. And we just ran out of time and didn't get the ability to ask him. But in any event, it's something to behold. Like I've been to plenty of conferences. Some places, some events are fun because of the city they're in. You know, like there's a lot of libertarian things that occur in Vegas. And so that's kind of exciting because, hey, you're going to Vegas, but you know, it's not like, oh yes, Auburn, Alabama in the middle of the summer. That sounds like my cup of tea. Anyway, I'll stop there. But especially if you're an undergrad student, it's designed for you. Unfortunately, I think we missed the window for this year's applications, but for sure, put that on your list of things to do. It's not like any other conference. So that's Mises University. In addition to his role in creating the Mises Institute, of course, Lou is the publisher of the very popular website, lourockwell.com. Again, I have some history with that. That's really when I was in grad school. I published a ton of stuff there that kind of got me into writing for a public audience. Also, Lou has some books. Fascism versus Capitalism is one of his more recent ones. He also, as we discuss in the interview, has a forthcoming book called Against the Left. And he's also just a very knowledgeable commentator on the American political scene. In particular, I'm sure those of you who listen to Tom Woods' show enjoy the episodes where Tom will have Lou on to talk about, like, if there was just a debate the night before or something like that, that those are always really fun episodes. So without further ado, here we go with my interview with Lou Rockwell. The particular jumping off point for this and why I grabbed him when I did is I saw his article on the college cheating scandal and he just hit it out of the park. He said exactly what I was thinking and did it much more eloquently and made some points I hadn't even thought of. And so I said, I gotta get him on the show. So here you go, folks, my conversation with Lou Rockwell. Well, thanks Lou for joining me here on the Bob Murphy Show. I'm glad to have you.
Bob, it's great to be with you.
So, Lou, what I wanted to have you on, of course, you've been on my short list of people that, oh, of course, at some point I got to get you on. But when I saw your article on the whole college cheating scandal, I thought, this is it. This is the sign. I got to get him on here. And just in general, I'm the kind of person that when everybody in society is having the two-minute hate of somebody, I always wait a second. I don't know if you remember this, Lou, but back for lourockwell.com, years ago, remember that the case of Andrew Speaker, the guy who had tuberculosis and he flew to go to his wedding and the whole country was outraged and, you know, yes. And I dug into it and found out that, well, no, actually his doctors told him it was fine and the local CDC person or something told him he recorded it because he knew it was fishy. So anyway, that was a case where the kind of thing here. And so in this case, for those who just vaguely know about it, let me read a key element of your article here just so everyone has the backdrop. And so the title of your article was The Provocative Free Lori Loughlin and All Political Prisoners. And here's just one excerpt from it just to give the backdrop for our listeners. A number of parents, including the actresses Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin, paid William Singer and his company, The Key, a total of about $25 million to get their children admitted to elite colleges. Singer paid people to take college admissions tests like the ACT, bribed coaches to say that the children of his clients were athletic recruits, and in general went all out for his clients. So it's the idea of there were like mid-tier, you know, not billionaires or multi-millionaires, but wealthy people who were paying this guy who had contacts at various elite schools to bend the rules in various ways, including just having coaches knowingly take somebody to be on like the rowing team or the crew team or something when they weren't even athletic to get them into this school. So that's the context. Of course, everybody's freaking out. I imagine the standard American, you know, saying, oh, these actresses, they're all pretty and they've been going through their lives, just everything handed to them on a silver platter. And now on top of that, they just pull some strings and get their kids jumping ahead of the line, ahead of my kids when I'm, you know, toiling. So you can understand why people would be outraged, and yet you took an opposite. You focused on a lot of things that haven't been covered, so I'll let you take it from there.
You know, I first became aware of this sort of thing when I was a boy, and when it came out that Joseph Kennedy had paid a ringer to take the SAT for Teddy Kennedy, who was then a student trying to get into Harvard, and then paid Harvard $1 million to take him. And I must say, we all thought it was sort of funny. Nobody thought that Joe Kennedy should go to jail, or maybe it would have been a good thing if Teddy Kennedy had gone to jail. He would have, a lot of evil might have been prevented, but not for this anyway. And more recently, of course, Jared Kushner, the alleged brains of the Trump administration, his father had to pay Harvard $2.5 million to take him as a student. This was a kid who went to top private schools, had all the benefits, and still, he couldn't get into Harvard, and I think he's been a disaster for the Trump administration. Maybe it's if you have to pay Harvard $2.5 million to take your kid as an undergraduate, maybe you don't want to put the government in his charge.
Exactly. So, and I like in your article here, you say, okay, so yes, it's true that we have other examples of very wealthy people just literally writing checks, like, you know, endowing buildings and things, and then, all of a sudden their kid seems to get in. And you take on the argument, someone might say, okay, yeah, sure, maybe we don't like that. Maybe that's not a meritocracy, but at least there, the rules are what they are. And people, you know, they paid their $1 million check fair and square to get their kid in at the head of the line. Whereas what these people did using Rick Singer was they cheated. They didn't even obey the rules.
Well, are the colleges taking action themselves? I mean, I don't see it. I'd like to know exactly who knew what. What about the admissions officers as well as the coaches? Higher ups in the administration. It's all very interesting. And of course, we have vast numbers of affirmative action people getting in who normally wouldn't get in. And then we have all the athletes, the actual athletes, who tend, not to be the best students. They all get in. So this sort of thing goes on all the time. And I was sorry to see that some poor Chinese man had paid a singer just before this whole thing blew up. $6.5 million to get his kid into some elite college. He paid too much, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, he could have just endowed a science building for $3 million. I mean, what's he doing?
So it's. I must say, I find it alarming when even good guys on TV are yucking it up that Lori Loughlin and the other 15 people who are pleading not guilty are all going to spend a lot of time in prison. Ha ha ha. I've heard the figure 20 years thrown around. I've heard 45 years. And of course, they could be mass murderers. They wouldn't get anything like these kinds of sentences. But to turn the government down when they want you to plead guilty is considered, of course, an unbelievably evil and rotten thing. But of course, there's nothing wrong with that. On the other hand, I heard somebody the other day point out that the U.S. government wins 99% of its cases, sort of like Vyshinsky during the Soviet show trials, except I guess he got 100%. But I hope they don't go to jail. But it seems like the feds are determined. The most recent thing is that the Laughlin lawyers and the other lawyers asked for the evidence. They said, we hear all this stuff about all these terrible things these people have done. Present the evidence. Apparently the feds have not actually presented the evidence. And they hate being made to go through a trial. They hate, like all government bureaucrats, they hate being made to do any work. And of course, there is work to go through a trial like this. So they want everybody to plea bargain, to agree to go to jail for some alleged lenient sentence of 2 or 3 years, which, of course, is a horrendous thing. I think that they're obviously, the U.S., of course, is the capital, the world capital of prison time. It's got far more people in prison than any other country and as a percentage, and maybe even in absolute numbers, especially since the drug war tuned up. So I think to want to put these people in prison, they've been humiliated. Their kids are going to be kicked out, probably, or maybe not. That's, again, up to the universities. But how come we don't learn about this? How about what's happened to the kids? Have they been kicked out? Are they still there? And again, what about the admissions officers? Is the entire system that corrupt? I think we need to know more. I'm sure there are going to be some interesting books written on this. But I hope to goodness these people are not put into one of these unbelievably evil federal prisons. I know Maria Butina, who's a Russian woman who came over to this country to try to promote the Russian sort of Second Amendment people, the people who think that Russians should be able to own guns more easily. And the U.S. arrested her and, of course, kept her in solitary confinement in this horrible prison in south of Washington, D.C., in Northern Virginia, where you're allowed 1 hour of outdoors, and that's at night. And otherwise, you're in solitary confinement. She was there for 10 months. And then, of course, that broke her. And you'd have to be a pretty unusual person not to be broken by that kind of thing. The government loves to put people in solitary confinement. But Lori Loeffner, will her husband, will these other people be put into solitary confinement, which is torture, of course? It's, I don't know, it's a terrible thing.
Yeah, I mean,
The government is a terrible thing, of course.
Sure. Yeah, on that point, I know a lot of people who don't really think through and, you know, like, oh, so you're sitting in a cell, you could work on your poetry or but I mean, that's the way, like in normal prisons with murderers and stuff, if somebody like causes a fight at lunch, the way that prison authorities punish you is by putting you in solitary. Like that's the leverage they use on like rapists and murderers to get them to behave is we'll put you in solitary if you don't clean up your act. So you raised a lot of good points there just to follow up on some of them. So yeah, the thing that amazes me with this is that clearly it would seem to me if a school, like the, in other words, the part of this scandal that I think is really the issue is that not that parents are willing to pay someone to cheat, but rather that the school personnel, like the coaches of a sports team, knowingly went along with, you know, like would tell the college administrators, oh, yeah, this so-and-so is a really good prospect. Like that was one of the things going on. And apparently this Rick Singer guy, you know, recruited some plants at or people at the various colleges, you know, that would play ball with him, presumably because he was paying them under the table. I don't know.
And what about the bureaucrats in the college? How come they're not keeping track of these students who turned out not to be great athletes, not to be on the crew team, not to be soccer players and so forth?
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of like
so I think there's a lot more going on here than we know about.
Exactly. Yeah, at the very least, clearly the administrators of the college don't care, or maybe they're in on it too. Just like if, you know, you hear about the Chicago police escorting drug dealers around because they're getting paid off. I mean, clearly their bosses must know that's going on. So they're at the very least they're okay with it, if not participating. Another thing you mentioned here, you know, you were responding to that is, and again, in case for people who don't know this, it's not merely that athletes get athletic scholarships to, you know, to go to an elite school when they're not going to be, you know, getting a PhD in physics or something. But it's well publicized, especially like at big football schools, you know, places where the sports program is huge. You know, there's certain campuses where that's the case. And clearly, you know, there's all kinds of cases where the professors who have those star athletes in their classes, you know, they get leaned on, especially, you know, if the team's competitive that season and they might go to the Final Four or something, if it's basketball, that the professors are leaned on to say, hey, you know, can you look again at this test? Are you sure he didn't maybe get, you can find some more points here. So, I mean, that stuff is well documented that there's quote cheating going on, you know, and even more explicit.
There are entire departments at universities that give phony grades and phony attendance to athletes. This has happened at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. There's a scandal at Auburn. Many other big universities that have big sports teams have scandal after scandal after scandal. Somehow nobody seems to care about that or sometimes even to know about it. It's not exactly on the front pages of the newspapers.
Right. And there, too, I mean, that's a complex thing. And, you know, maybe the solution is to let those athletes just get paid. You know what I mean? Maybe it's not that far.
No, yeah. I think these big universities should have professional teams.
Yeah.
And this is, and then these kids, yes, they should be paid. They're doing a valuable service for the university, and that's not by getting degrees or going to classes. So it's this is of course entirely corrupt too. But nobody's going to jail over that.
Yeah, and it's funny too because that's obviously an outgrowth of I think just the general distaste for capitalism. Like, you know, ooh, no, it's icky. You wouldn't want to have student athletes get, but meanwhile, it's fine for the coach, you know, to get paid tons of money. You know, for the winning coaches to get paid a bunch of money for the labor of the student athletes. Another thing you brought up in this article that I mean, it's a simple point, but it just hadn't occurred to me is you're right. We're vilifying these people. And when you step back and, you know, obviously, you know, it's not a good example for your kid if they realize, oh, my parents were pulling strings and cheating. And, you know, that's probably not good for your kid growing up in that environment to have your parents doing that. But nonetheless, what they were doing was for their kids. I mean, whereas like you're saying, other celebrities who get caught doing lines of cocaine and drinking and getting pulled over when they were endangering people on the road or get, you know, athletes beating up their wives or girlfriends or something. They, you know, that would be on the news for one cycle and go away and nobody would care. But yet, how dare these people pay a bunch of money to get their kids into a good school? How dare they? I mean, something's weird about that.
Yeah. Well, any of us who are parents know that we do about anything for our children. And we might not have the money to do this. We might not even think this was a good idea. But we have to have sympathy, it seems to me, for these other parents.
Yeah. And what's funny is I even heard some of the people like, in, you know, in comment sections or with Twitter, people just reacting to this stuff. And the way they spun that, the way they tried to neuter the alleged, you know, altruism of this or parental pride and, you know, looking out for your kid was to say something like, oh, these actresses and these Hollywood, it's a badge of honor. In other words, like it's a trophy. They just want to be able to brag at cocktail parties about their kids getting into such. And I'm saying, okay, even on its own terms, though, that's better than saying, hey, look at my fancy car or, you know, oh, we bought our third home in Malibu. You know what I mean? Like at least they're bragging about their kids. That's something better than what, you know, you imagine the typical Hollywood celebrity would be bragging about. So even there, it's hard for me to get stirred up into this huge outrage over, you know, these awful people who cut corners to get their kids into a good school.
No, it's a terrible thing. And I noticed now that the feds are threatening that if the parents don't immediately do a plea deal and of course, for much more prison time than allegedly they would have gotten originally, they're going to go after the kids and put the kids in jail.
Right, which is just horrifying. And so, again, for the listeners who don't, you know, aren't up to speed. So apparently this is coming from, at least I saw, like sources who are with the families, like, you know, telling the press saying originally they were, you know, some of these people were going to fight it. Like you say, Lou, going to court because the government's not used to it. They're just used to everybody rolling over. But apparently the Fed. And so the way these plea deals work is the government comes to you and says, here, if you plead such, you know, if you just say you're guilty, you'll get this reduced sentence. If it goes to trial, though, and then we convict you there, you're going to get a much heavier penalty. And that whole process, that, I mean, that's perverse.
And also the government openly says and does brings more and more charges against you the longer you hold out. So they find more and more alleged crimes that you committed. So your jail sentence can be more and more. I mean, this is like something out of, again, the Soviet Union.
Right. And it's even if it's just, you know, charges against you, that's perverse. And again, the analogy I use with people, I might do a separate episode on this, folks, just to walk you through the logic. Like, if the government approached someone and said, hey, we'll pay you $100,000 to say that this guy over here committed a crime, everybody would agree, whoa, that you can't do that. That's going to lead to a false conviction. If the government approached someone and said, hey, we'll put you in jail for 10 years unless you testify this guy over here did something wrong, again, the government's threatening someone to produce testimony, most people would say that's not right. So it doesn't change the nature of that if the government's saying to you, testify against yourself. In other words, even if you thought you were innocent, if you get offered a plea deal, you might just agree, yep, I did it, because you want to get the reduced sentence rather than risk going to jail for 20 years or prison for 20 years. And then it makes it just a higher level of evil when they're saying to you, admit you did something wrong or else we're going to put your kids through this process too, which is, again, what some of the people close to the families are saying. The feds are saying that they better just roll over or else, you know, in other words, if you agree you did it, we'll prosecute you and give you a lighter sentence and we'll leave your kids alone. But if you don't play ball, if you fight this, then, you know, standing up for your alleged right to a trial, then we're going to bring your kids into it as well, which is just horrifying.
Why, Bob, is this a federal crime, by the way? Why is the FBI involved? And of course, they love it because they're getting so much publicity and I'm hoping they'll all go to jail for what they did to Trump. But in the meantime, of course, they're trying to hurt other people. And again, even if this is a crime, why isn't it a local crime? But I'm not sure it's a crime anyway, but let's say it is a crime. Why is it a federal crime? Why is it indeed a major league felony? And it's, you know, it looks like they could, they're at least threatening to put them in jail for more time than if they'd murdered somebody.
Yeah, it is amazing.
Of course, government doesn't care about murder because they're not, unless it's a murder of a government official, because of course it doesn't affect the government. But that's our government.
Yeah, and you're right. Again, for people that haven't really followed this didn't. It would be one thing, Lou, you know, if some investigative reporter broke the story, you know, somebody in California that was on the beat, you know, and realized this was, you know, that'd be kind of a cool, you know, feather in their cap. That, oh yeah, back in the day when I was working this beat, I broke the story. You know, okay, because it is interesting to realize there's this widespread payments going on and systematic cheating by, you know, college administrators and coaches and things. You know, that's okay. But you're right. The fact that the FBI had this big sting operation to break this up, that's amazing. And the other thing, maybe this is a good way to just transition beyond this case in general. Why is it all of a sudden that the left are fans of the FBI? I mean, this is the same FBI that famously, you know, tried to get Martin Luther King to commit suicide. More recently, with the Richard Jewell thing with the bombing and how the FBI was involved and this guy, you know, the whole was railroaded by the media and so forth. The FBI was clearly involved until they finally had to back off. So, I mean, is it just so simple as the left is that short sighted? And because now they think the FBI can help with Trump, or is it just they like power? What are your thoughts on that? You would think the left would be suspicious of the FBI.
Yeah, the left loves the state. And they love all the so-called intelligence agencies, the 16 intelligence agencies. I was glad to see Tucker Carlson was arguing with somebody last night, and the guy said, "Look, you can't get away from the fact that 16 intelligence agencies agreed that there was Russian collusion." And he and Carlson said, "And there were 16 intelligence agencies agreed there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq too." And you know, who knows what other lies, of course, they've been peddling. So, but I think the left loves the police state. They didn't always love the police state when they were on the other side, when the police state maybe was aimed at them. But now that at least not entirely, but mostly they're in charge of the police state, they're very happy with it. They love using it against the rest of us. And it's of course, the FBI is... If we want to talk in old-fashioned terms, I would say it's, you know, clearly unconstitutional. Nothing in the Constitution for such an agency. CIA, too, which also is, of course, the sort of the elder brother of the FBI and the even more evil and murders more people and doesn't put them in jail, just kills them. And these are terrible, terrible agencies. Why, by the way, are there 16 so-called intelligence agencies? And what are the names of them? Of course, we don't know the names, but
it's probably a lot of acronyms.
Well, I think the left loves all this stuff, and these were all leftists within the FBI who were going up against the Trump administration or the Trump campaign, and then the administration. So it's I think they love the power. They love being able to hurt people, people who are in government, who rise in government. In general, they love hurting people. They love killing people. They love starting wars. They love starving people in Venezuela. And it's hilarious that the U.S. government admitting that they're putting on these sanctions and have had these sanctions since 2015 in Venezuela to cause starvation and sickness and all other kinds of problems for Venezuela. They admit that they're doing it, and then they say, oh, look, socialism has caused this. Well, of course, socialism is capable of a lot of bad stuff, but the U.S. is doing bad stuff in Venezuela, too. And I think they like it. I mean, that's at least part of it. There's the oil. The U.S. likes never be turned down. We have the hilarious example of the Monroe Doctrine being thrown around. Why, by the way, is some statement by an American president in the 1830s supposed to have any relevance? He said, by the way, it's very interesting to read the Monroe Doctrine. He said, you people in Western Europe, you stay out of the Western Hemisphere, we'll stay out of Western Europe.
Right.
Somehow that part of the Monroe Doctrine was forgotten and went away. But
and why don't we have like the Madison Doctrine about federalism or so? You know what I mean? That's all these particular things that they
The Jefferson Doctrine, yeah. So that's right.
So this is probably a good time then to transition, because I solicited questions from the people in my private Facebook group, and so if we can go through some of those.
Sure.
But yeah,
great.
Venezuela, I did want to ask you about that. Because I remember when I was young, when I was first getting into libertarianism, I'm sure I would have watched the news and my takeaway would have been, wow, there's an evil dictator in Venezuela and socialism doesn't work. These poor people are starving. And, look at this spontaneous uprising of the people to throw off the shackles of a socialist regime. And I stand with the people of Venezuela against Maduro. And now I realize that's a pretty naive view. So can you give a little bit more as to someone who thinks like that? Can you just explain why, that's not the right take necessarily?
Well, first of all, they call Maduro a dictator. He was elected. One of the reasons he was elected, perhaps the only reason he was elected, was that the opposition, Guaido and Leopoldo Lopez and so forth, boycotted the election. They didn't run. So now we're saying, and he really is the real president. Oh, okay, right. But he wasn't elected, if we're going to use those terms. And they've hated. They've been after Venezuela ever since Chavez took over. The U.S. staged a number of coups against Chavez, a number of coups against Maduro, and of course they haven't worked. Venezuela apparently has got the largest oil reserves in the world. Maybe that has something to do with what's going on. But I think it's just U.S. hates to be turned down. If they decide to destroy a country, that country better agree to be destroyed. How dare they? How dare they resist? And so we have Pompeo and the rest of these guys openly saying, we're putting on these sanctions to cause suffering by the Venezuelan people so they'll overthrow Maduro. That's, of course, what they did in Iraq, killed more than 500,000 civilians, children and old people. And the Secretary of State famously said, we think it's worth it. Yeah, so she was an overweight lady. She didn't seem to have any problems getting food, but she was happy to starve these people, sicken these people. And the U.S. has done this again and again with sanctions. Trump seems to be sort of a sanctions champion. He's put them on Cuba now recently, and they just love, I guess, starving people. I don't notice any of the advocates of free trade criticizing these horrible anti-free trade sanctions by the U.S. And it's plenty wrong with Venezuela. One of the things that's interesting, I just found out myself a couple of days ago, that Maduro took away people's guns. So that's an interesting point. If the people had guns, he wouldn't be in power. We can't actually know, but why shouldn't this be up to the Venezuelan people? Why? We have all the U.S. talking about, oh, the Russians are trying to meddle in our democracy and they're trying to do this and that here. Does the U.S., by the way, ever meddle in anybody else's elections? Does it meddle in the Russian election? Of course, there's actually a U.S. agency, the National Endowment for Democracy, that actually is in charge of meddling in other people's elections.
Yeah.
It's actually openly, right. It's part of the CIA, but I mean, it's openly does so. They have a Republican division, a Democratic division. So each of those parties is on the federal payroll of this sort of thing, of the CIA kind of operations. And I remember when the Russian elections earlier the Time magazine was heralding the fact that the U.S. had gotten its candidate elected in Russia. They were openly saying so. And, of course, the U.S. So it's I'm sure there's plenty wrong with Venezuela. There's plenty wrong with that government. But it seems to me every time the U.S. intervenes, of course, it does far more damage, kills far more people, wrecks far more economic havoc than was the case. And, of course, it never turns out the way we're promised it's going to turn out. We're still, of course, in Afghanistan, Iraq. The U.S., of course, I guess would just make Venezuela a colony and could just pump the oil directly. And wouldn't that be fun? So I think I think most of us, by the way, know relatively little about Venezuela. And it's my understanding that, for example, the supermarkets are still open. People can still get food. The prices are way up. There's a limited number of items available, but people are still able to get food, at least if they have the money. So what the U.S. has done, it made food unavailable to the poorest people. And just recently I saw where 40,000 people have died as a result of these sanctions. And, of course, it's caused tremendous amounts of displacement of the population into other countries. And we would actually see, the estimate is 8 million Venezuelans come to this country if the U.S. overthrows Maduro. Certainly, that's what we need. We need more refugees. We need more people coming into this country to go on welfare. Wouldn't that be great? But again, nobody discusses this sort of thing. I saw a guy called, I'm trying to think of what the first part of his name is. His last part of his name is Ballart, who's a Cuban-American congressman from Florida, taking the entire neocon line the other day. And he said, well, it's very important that we accept all the refugees from Venezuela, no matter how many millions there are. Because it's in it's in a national security interest. Our national security interest. Anyway, you know, they can just say anything.
Right.
So Venezuela. Again, my guess is they'll take care of things themselves. They should be able to take care of things themselves. Think about how angry people got here about the notion, entirely made up, of course, that Russia was meddling in our elections and running things here. But yet we think it's perfectly fine. The U.S. does that to every other country on earth. So it's, I guess this is a terrible fact that the American people like being the rulers. They like the fact that the U.S. wants to be the world government, could be the world government, is mostly the world government, and probably the only government in history actually able to carry out such a thing at, of course, vast cost to our liberty and to our economic well-being here. But again, who cares about that? As long as the elites are doing well, it's a terrible thing. And do Americans care about what's being done to Venezuela? Of course, we hear all the propaganda. Just the other day, we heard, well, Guaido is going to be overthrowing Maduro, and he's going to be the president. Everything's going to be great, and the troops are going to be with him, and so forth. Of course, it turned out all to be a lie. Don't believe the government. That's probably one good rule of citizenship. Never believe anything the government says until it's proven by other sources to be correct.
And that's the thing that's surprising. I mean, I could see, in other words, like a regular American who doesn't really follow politics much. They're taking their kid to soccer practice and they kind of just say, well, I'm sure the people in the government aren't that bad. But for like somebody who calls him or herself a libertarian and who on domestic policy knows that, oh, yes, the minimum wage is horrible. And they when they try to revitalize inner cities with rent control and big projects, you know, it's terrible. So why would you think all of a sudden that this government then can go and rebuild other countries from scratch? I mean, that's just, it's boggling to think about it. You said
all the pro-war libertarians, of course, are in favor of that sort of thing.
Right. And it doesn't add up. Yeah. And it's funny too about the meddling. I read a while ago, so I think this was before Trump was elected, but I think it was like the National Intelligence Estimate or so. It was like NIE or so. It was the thing with all these agencies when they were talking about Russia's meddling. And what was funny is one of their bullet points in terms of establishing, like, why would the Russian government care about who wins in 2016? And one of their points was that, oh, the Russians don't like Hillary Clinton. And why? Because when she was Secretary of State, she was publicly weighing in on their elections. You know, she was taking a position about which part. So it's kind of like, oh, the reason they're meddling is because we meddled in there, but with no irony at all. You know what I mean? They didn't, the bullet points didn't seem to recognize that. Well, wait a minute. So we're mad at the Russians for doing something way less than what you're admitting that we did to them. So it is kind of funny how, or just in general, when people say, I know when it was a thing for a while to say, hey, maybe George W. Bush and Dick Cheney should be accused of war crimes and be tried in some international court. Most Americans, like, it wasn't a matter of them looking at the evidence and saying, no, I don't think that rises to. It was just, no, by definition, U.S. presidents can't commit war crimes because we're always the good guys. Maybe we make a mistake in judgment. Maybe we get into a quagmire trying to help some people, you know, with our blood and treasure, that maybe it was a foolish decision. But gosh darn it. You know what I mean? Like, just the idea that the U.S. president could commit a war crime, I think to a lot of Americans, that's literally impossible just by its very nature. U.S. presidents can't do that.
I think that's true. I think too many Americans have that exact view, and they think that certainly every country in the world would be better off being run by the U.S., and there would be no negative consequences to us if we're running them. And, of course, one of the consequences that happens to an empire happened to ancient Rome, it happened to Britain, it happened to France and other empires, is the imperial people you're ruling in other countries end up moving to your country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, of course, what's happening here, and it's the result of the empire. The U.S., of course, runs an empire. It's not a republic, and I still hear people saying, we must have a republic and not an empire. Well, okay, but it's been a very, very long time since this was not an empire. This has been an empire certainly since World War II, and in many instances before World War II, and It's an alarming operation, the U.S. Empire. If the U.S. Empire is coming to free you, you better build a hole in the ground and pull the dirt over yourself, because there's trouble coming.
Well, let me, before we run out of time here, let me give you a chance to talk about your forthcoming book, Against the Left. So can you tell the listeners about that and what they can do?
Well, it's called Against the Left, and the subtitle is The Rothbardian Libertarianism. And making the point that Hoppe makes, that Rothbard makes, that other people have made, that libertarianism grows best in a right-wing cultural environment, that with strong families and other strong private institutions, and that if you have, as the government gets bigger and bigger, it wants to destroy all intermediating institutions. They want to destroy churches. They want to destroy businesses. They want to destroy families. They want to destroy everything that, as Robert Nisbet points out, prevents the situation where it's the naked individual and the massive state, and those are the only two institutions. And then, of course, we know who wins in that. So it's just arguing that the left is the great enemy. There were certainly indications of leftism before the French Revolution and the ancient world. There was certainly egalitarianism, Procrustes, the legendary king famously had an iron bed of a certain length, and when you were a guest in his home, he would fit you into the bed, and if you were too long, he'd cut off your feet. If you were too short, he'd stretch you on the rack until you filled the bed, because not everybody should be that size. There was another king who when asked what was the secret of his being able to rule so successfully, he was actually a dictator rather than a king, but he took the ambassador out into his garden where he had poppies growing, and he took his sword and he cut off all the tall poppies. And he didn't say anything, and of course the guy got the point, that you want to cut off and get rid of the more successful people, the wealthier people, the smarter people, because they might pose a danger to the dictator. So when the French Revolution came, all the horrendous, not only the guillotines, one of their favorite things was to put people and bake them slowly in bread ovens to death, They were a great bunch, the French revolutionaries. And, of course, total militarism, national draft, conquering other countries, and getting rid of religion, or rather making a terrible parody of religion as the official religion, where they had prostitutes performing on the altar of Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, that, of course, recently burned down, or mostly burned down. And the French Revolution really spawned communism, spawned every sort of horrible thing that's happened since then, and that, yes, there have been terrible right-wing things, although I would argue in the tradition of Erich von Knud-Ladin that Hitler and the National Socialists were left-wingers. They were not right. Even though the left refers to them as right-wingers, they were not right-wingers. They were left-wingers. And so that's mankind's great enemy is the state, but the left state is the worst possible thing of all. So Hans Hoppe was very kind to write a wonderful introduction to this book, and I hope to have it out within a couple of months. I still have to raise money for it and do the index and a few other things like that, but it's pretty much done.
Okay, great. So yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes page, folks, if you want to see what you can do to get your hands on that and to contribute to it. So again, this is bobmurphyshow.com/32 to see the links here. Somebody asks, Lou, could you talk about what the church committee hearings were and if that is politically possible now in response to all these revelations about Russiagate and so on? For the listeners, what were the church committee hearings, and then could that happen today?
Senator Frank Church from Idaho chaired these hearings, and they were unbelievably tremendous hearings. This is in the 1970s, and he talked about the CIA and what they were doing in terms of control of the media, how they had people in every newspaper and every major newspaper in the Associated Press, the UPI, the major TV networks, and how they killed people. I'll always remember when he had a demonstration of a gun that the CIA had developed that would shoot cyanide out. And so the guy would knock on your door, you'd open the door, put the gun in your face, pull the trigger, and it would send a puff of cyanide into your face. And I guess everybody's natural reaction to that sort of thing is to go, and you would breathe in the cyanide, and you know that was the end of you. And it, after a relatively short time, it was undetectable in your bloodstream. And he talked about how the CIA was killing people, how they wanted to control the entire country. And I still have a set of the hearings. And by the way, the hearings are still available from the government printing office. 6 giant volumes, extremely interesting documentation, very, very relevant today. And Frank Church was a leftist, but he sure was great on this kind of thing. He's a great civil libertarian. And, you know, I must say I can't see anything like that happening. I think the CIA runs the Congress as well as other parts of the government. I remember when Trump made a comment about the CIA early on, and Chuck Schumer said, you better watch it, you know, because they have other ways of getting back at you if you go after them.
And yeah, that was amazing. I think Glenn Greenwald picked up on that and just said, how come people aren't outraged that he's just matter-of-factly saying the CIA behind the scenes is going to lean on the president-elect? I mean, that's chilling. It should be. But yet everyone's like, aha, you know, like as if like that's just the way the world is, you idiot Trump. I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah, it was quite something. So the CIA is, and I noticed that even though the Republicans are now, you know, talking about, we got to get that the FBI, we got to have investigations and get those guys who were trying to get Trump. But the CIA was involved. And of course, the heads of the National Intelligence head and the head of the CIA were both involved. This seems to have dropped out. I don't see anybody talking about the CIA anymore because, of course, they're all afraid. And I guess you can't blame them in one sense for being afraid, but they're there in Congress. They're supposed to be representing the people, and they're not supposed to just be toadies, but of course they are toadies. But we need another Frank Church. We need more. Ron Paul was, of course, talked about the CIA. I'll never forget when he went on Bill Buckley's show, Firing Line, when Ron was running for Libertarian Party president, and this would be 1987. And so Buckley was sort of charming to him and indulgent and so forth. And it was only when the subject of the CIA came up, and of course Buckley was a quote-unquote ex-CIA agent, that he became extremely hostile, extremely angry, and extremely upset that Ron Paul wanted to abolish the CIA because he thought it was an evil institution and, of course, unconstitutional and shouldn't exist. So this is of course, an institution far more powerful today, far bigger, far more agents, far more people on the payroll in other countries as well. And it's an alarming bunch, and they do kill people. I remember talking to one expert on the CIA, and I said, are they still killing people within the U.S.? And he said yes. And I said, how do they still use the old cyanide gun? He said no. He said they do it on the operating table. He said it's the easiest to kill somebody on the operating table in a way that can't be traced. And so if all of a sudden you've got to have surgery and you're an anti-CIA activist, you know, you might watch it.
That's good to know. All right. Is that why they want universal health cover so everyone can afford to?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then I guess since you're bringing up all these things, but this next question here that I have on the list, someone wants to know, you know, what was your view of the John Birch Society when you were coming of age, and they had this reputation of all these conspiracy theorists, but I mean, a lot of the stuff with this Council on Foreign Relations and all these things, I mean, those groups do exist and you can go look at them. So wondering, you know, did they maybe get a bad rap? Or so just what are your thoughts on that stuff?
I like the John Birch Society. I grew up in the town, Belmont, Massachusetts, that was where the Birch Society was. I knew Robert Welch, who was the head of it, and very, very interesting guy, very smart, very learned. And I was lucky to be able to talk to him a number of times, and he would give me libertarian books to read. He was a libertarian, except, when it came to what both he and J. Edgar Hoover referred to as the communist conspiracy. And but I would say, outside of that, I think that they were wrong on that. I remember every year the American Opinion, which was the Birch Society magazine, which was a pretty good magazine. Rob, by the way, Ludwig von Mises was an editor of that and sometimes wrote for it. And this was not, a fly-by-night kind of thing. But every year they would bring out an issue about going over every country in the world, what percentage they were controlled by the communists. And the U.S., it was 60-80%. And I remember saying, not to Mr. Welch, but to who I never would have said this to at that point. I was just a teenager. But somebody else who was a member of the Birch Society, I said, if this is true, why is the society so pro-military and so pro-FBI and so pro-CIA? I mean, if the communists are running things 60-80%, how come you're for these agencies, which might be even more targets of the communists? Mm-hmm. And he kind of sputtered and just got upset at me. So they were, you know, I think they were unsound on those kinds of questions. But whether it was the Federal Reserve, warfare state, revisionist history in terms of World War, of all American wars, they were just sound in many, many different ways. But they I think had the wrong view of the communists. Not that the communists were great guys. Obviously, they were extremely evil. But because of their economic problems, they were never the threat to us or to the world, for that matter, that was portrayed. They were able to conquer Eastern Europe because the U.S. did that for them. They were able to stay and fight World War II because the U.S. did vast, you know, gave vast foreign aid and all kinds of other aid to Stalin, who was an ally of the U.S. We should always remember that Joseph Stalin, Uncle Joe, was a very close ally of the U.S. in World War II. And it was because we were fighting Hitler. Was Stalin worse than Hitler? Was he better than Hitler? I think if anything, he certainly was no better than Hitler, and killed far more people than even the Nazis killed. So it's tough to think of being on the side of either one of those guys, I must say.
Yeah, I remember, I don't know if it was in Human Action or somewhere else, but Mises when he was talking of some of my favorite passages are when Mises talks about military tactics and things, you know what I mean? Cause it's, you know, just to hear someone of that stature and knowledge of history, just to talk about, you know, military engagements. But yeah, he said something along the lines of, you know, no capitalist country has ever lost to a socialist country in a war. And then said, yeah, even the alleged, you know, contributions of the Soviet Union and during World War II, it was only made possible because of American military aid, you know, the sending over supplies and whatnot. That he thought, if I remember correctly, he thought, yeah, if it were just Nazi Germany against the Soviet Union in and of themselves, that wouldn't have turned out that way.
Well, I think that's true. Of course, Mises was right.
Let me ask you this. So someone else brings up, so first of all, tell us whether this is correct or not, but my recollection is that Rothbard said something like he was a pessimist in terms of liberty and the prospects for liberty. He was a pessimist in the short run, but an optimist in the long run. So is that what he, do you agree he said something along those lines?
And then yes, so, that was your view too,
or do you disagree?
Well, I think that, you know, that in fact has to be our view, or otherwise you're just a nihilist and a pessimist. So I do, he felt that, that capitalism meant that in the long run that we would win. I think that there are many, many indications that that's true, other indications that it's not true. But I think Rothbard had some wonderful, wonderful articles on that. And in fact, he wrote a lot of his best stuff on that particular issue in his letters. And by the way, David Gordon right now is doing an annotated collection of Rothbard's letters. My guess is it'll be about four big volumes.
Wow.
Rothbard's letters, each one, it's tough to describe them. Each one is like a scholarly article that's hilarious. I mean, he was a very funny guy and very learned, loved gossip, loved scholarship, and his letters are just so funny, so interesting, so learned. These are going to be tremendous volumes. And David, this is a very huge project. But of course, David is the guy to do it. He has all the knowledge and, of course, was a very close friend of Murray's.
Yeah. And my understanding is that his letters were not a page and a half of pleasantries. Like, it was some serious in-depth stuff.
No. And I remember Bob Higgs after talking about sending a manuscript to Murray and getting back 23 pages of suggestions about things he ought to read and include in his book. And he said, if I would have spent the rest of my life, I never would have had time to go, all of which, of course, Rothbard was intimately familiar with. But he said he took a year and redid his book. And he said when he always was impressed that when Murray reviewed his book, which he loved, he never mentioned his own role in it. And that... That was Murray. He was, I think, sort of in, I don't want to compare him to Milton Friedman because I think he was a far more significant figure than Milton Friedman. But Milton Friedman was very, very smart. But he was unbelievably arrogant. I mean, he loved, if somebody asked him what he thought was a dumb question, he loved really crushing a student. And he was a nasty guy as a person, at least in public. And Murray was humble, despite all the knowledge that he had, very humble, friendly, funny, interesting guy. And I think a lot of that doesn't necessarily come through in his more serious works, come through in these letters that are just astounding. And I'll tell a story about George Reisman. And I said, George, I'm looking through the archives, and I said, there's the most interesting Murray letter where he says that George Reisman agrees with me that really Ayn Rand is a totalitarian.
Hmm.
And there were other things in this long, long letter. And George said, well, that's ridiculous. I never said such a thing. He said, can you get me the letter? I said, sure, I'll get it to you. So I sent it to him. And he wrote me about a month later, and Murray was actually right. He said, because Rand's view was that rationality was necessary to life, and that if you were irrational, you had no right to life and could be killed. And he said so that when they tossed me out of the official Ayn Rand network, If they could have killed me, they probably would have killed me. He said, so he said they actually do have those kinds of views, although they're not things they talk about in public very much.
Right. Huh. That is interesting. And it's funny you mentioned that, because I thought that too about Milton Friedman. You know, so you see a lot of fans of, and obviously, as you acknowledge, clearly Milton Friedman, you know, is a very smart guy. And
oh my gosh.
Good
yes.
economist and everything like that, and did a lot for bringing people
great
into
debater,
the free market
yeah.
ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like some of the most popular clips, like when he's, is it on Donahue where he's talking about what is greed? What is, you know, and people love that clip, but yet he is kind of real intimidating and in your face and aggressive. Whereas you see clips of Rothbard giving public lectures and it's like Rothbard's goal is to make you laugh. Friedman's goal is to make you agree with him.
You know? or to crush you if you don't.
Right. And so yeah, it's, I do see what you mean, that it's just different styles. And yes, it is that, you know, Friedman's really in your face and aggressive, whereas Rothbard's like trying to entertain you or something. And is just a funny guy. If you have time for one more, perhaps.
Sure.
Okay, great. So someone wants to know, the immediate question is, do you think Trump could have won the election if he didn't have the internet? And then more broadly, you know, what do you think is going to happen in the next election?
Well, I think that he probably could not have won without the internet. So that, and I, even as upset as I am with Trump in so many different areas, I still think it's better that he's in there than Hillary. What's going to happen in 2020? I think he's probably going to win. I think the Democrats. If Barr and the other people in the Department of Justice go after the people who tried the coup, go after the people at least in the FBI who the FISA court, the FISA documents, all these things that were used. But I think the one thing that I wonder about, I don't think Trump could have won the election if he hadn't been. At least on the margin, an anti-war, anti-interventionist guy. I mean, he actually said some great things about past U.S. mistakes,
mm-hmm.
and of course, none of which have been fulfilled. He's been just the opposite. He's got the worst kinds of neocons in power. Is that because he's been threatened? I don't know. That doesn't. I don't think that forgives him. This time he's going to be running as a warmonger, even though he's not going to call himself that. Unless, of course, if he gets the troops out of Afghanistan, there's talk about that. If he gets the troops out of Syria, he still could win those kinds of laurels into the 2020 election. If he runs as the guy who wants to crush Venezuela and every other place that says boo to him, we'll just have to see. But I think. If Barr and the people in the Justice Department, and I must say I don't have a lot of faith in this, but let's say they do what we're being told they're going to do, then the Democrats could be crushed because of the things that they did in order to spy on Trump, the CIA, the FBI, and I guess maybe the 14 other agencies too, also spying on him, and it was a. Really, it's totalitarian, of course. But the U.S. has long since ceased to be a free society, and this is among the rulers. So it may not have, it may not be directly as the same as spying on our bank account and our discussions in our homes and those kinds of things. But it's still pretty terrible, pretty scary, in fact. So we just have to see and hope, pray that. The bad guys get punished, and that maybe Trump will see the light on some of these foreign policy questions. That maybe he, you know, is not going to try to crush China and thinks that the U.S. should be. Why? How dare China say that they should have something to say about the South China Sea? Why? That's
right.
We'd welcome them to have their ships in the Gulf of Mexico. Oh, right? Yeah. So that he didn't actually say that, by the way. So it's. Just have to see, hope that maybe if he was telling the truth, and who knows whether these guys ever tell the truth, if he was telling the truth or some of the truth in his last election campaign, that he carries out some of those promises. It's never too late to do the right thing, Donald. So please do it.
Yeah, I mean, is it is it too simple? I wonder, just watching it again, not judging the morality of it, but because, yeah, you, when he first came in, he picked a fight with the CIA. And then pretty early on, he went to the CIA headquarters and he had, like, he was given a speech to the rank and file. And he was working the room. I don't know if you know how Trump can be real charming and cracking jokes and kind of win people over in the room. And he was doing that with the rank and file. So what I thought was, he just, you know, sized up his battles and realized, you know what, right now I don't want to take on the CIA. And he kind of backed off. But, you know, there was, right after he won the election,
yeah,
he was picking fights with the CIA.
Oh, publicly. Yeah. It was great.
And so is it possible, too, with, like, the neocons that, you know, did he make a deal with those guys, you know, realizing, I cannot believe how complacent the media is to just go along with complete nonsense to try to invalidate my victory. So maybe I need some friends at National Review, and who knows? But do you think that kind of thing was going on?
I think that anything like that is possible, yes. I'd like to see, of course, Brennan questioned under oath, and these other CIA people who were clearly running this whole coup attempt. Will that happen? Are they just too powerful? I don't know. Although they are, of course, the secret police, not only the FBI, the CIA, these other 14 agencies. We have 14 secret police agencies in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, is it possible to go up against them? You know, I don't know. I'd like to think so, but you'd have to get the people on your side. You have to educate the people. And would he then be assassinated? You know, it's
well. If he hears this episode, he knows he shouldn't go in for any surgical operations anytime soon.
Certainly not in the government hospital in Bethesda.
Right, exactly. Okay. Well, thanks so much for your time, Lou. I'll let you go here. We really appreciate your insight, and I will point everyone to your forthcoming book, Against the Left. And thanks so much for joining me,
Bob. Thank you very much. It's an honor to be on your show.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.